Under the radar means hearing about things you didn't know you needed to know until you hear them.
It's a serious look.
You hear about the issues that don't get the attention they deserve.
Under the radar doesn't get caught up in the day-to-day.
Surfacing issues that are not talked about in mainstream media.
I think it's something that connects us to each other.
Under the radar is all about discovery.
I can be guaranteed voices I haven't heard before.
But also the questions.
Under the radar is one step ahead.
I'm Callie Crossley. This week on Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, A-listers Billie Eilish, Stevie Wonder, and the Jonas Brothers have joined more than 200 U.S. musicians in an open letter demanding protections against artificial intelligence. The group argues the new tech could undermine or replace human artists. Plus, Beyoncé's record-breaking album, Cowboy Carter, is pushing boundaries in country music, highlighting the genre's Black artists and Black history. And comedian Kevin Hart's peers tap him for the prestigious Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. It's our pop culture roundtable. Later in the show, heartwarming stories have shaped what many Americans know about the American adoption process. But a new book chronicles a far different reality.
The system is not set up to hold these experiences and give them the support and investment that they need in the long term.
Qualitative sociologist Gretchen Sisson details how the adoption process is more often a source of trauma for birth mothers and an incentive for profit for some adoption brokers. Her new book, Relinquished, The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood, is our April selection for Bookmarked, the Under the Radar Book Club. But first, joining me, Michael Jeffries, Dean of Academic Affairs and Professor of American Studies at Wellesley College. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Callie.
Also with me, Karen Wong, lecturer on history and literature at Harvard University. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you for having me, Callie.
Oh, I'm glad to have both of you. Well, let's jump right in with the protests, the signed letter by 200 musicians, a lot of them A-listers. We saw the issue of artificial intelligence come up during the strikes of the actors and the writers over the last year. And now it's the musicians saying, wait a minute, we have to say something because there's been so much manipulation already that we've heard about. The pornographic images of Taylor Swift, one of the artists who said he couldn't even recognize the fact that his voice had been altered, and it wasn't his voice. It was a kind of mechanized version of his voice, but it sounded that good that threw him off. So here is the Artists' Rights Alliance letter sent out saying, you got to stop it. They didn't ask for an outright ban, but what say you two about what this means and what it could mean? I'll start with you, Karen.
This is really reminiscent of the Hollywood strikes in the past summer, right? Like, a big part of what the actors were arguing for was that they wanted AI protection or protection against AI use of their images, essentially. And it's the same thing now in the music industry. And one thing that I think all of these people in the entertainment are fighting for is essentially use of human creativity against the forces of capitalism, which demands profit as like the be all end all at the end of the day. And you know, AI is basically a shortcut for them to get that. So I see this as definitely like analogous to the SAG strikes in the summer, as a way to contend with like, what does the presence of AI mean for the entertainment industry? And how do we reckon with, you know, these forces of capitalism and the need for consumption and thinking about that versus like, you know, human output and what is genuinely artistry and creativity versus what is just sound.
I should add that the estates of Frank Sinatra and Bob Marley also signed on to this letter, Michael. How do you see it?
Well, I think the first thing that strikes me is this is very similar to the previous story, as Karen mentioned. And it seems to be a case where we're really starting to understand that the technology has just moved so much faster than the legislative and sort of corporate or industry guardrails could possibly move. It seems like we're all kind of late to the party here, right? Like, these things are already out there. These tools are already out there. These songs are already being made. And we're now trying to go back in time and retroactively put some guardrails around this thing. I think there are a couple of different pieces of it, though. One is there is, I think, a legitimate debate around whether AI is another tool of creativity or an infringement, an attack on creativity. And I think there's a split among artists on this. I mean, you'll talk to some people who think, you know, this is inevitable. This is the future of creativity. And rather than reject it, we need to embrace it. And you'll talk to other folk who draw the red line and say, you know what, this is an assault on my humanity. Not just my my business, not just the way I make my living, but who I am as a person, how I understand myself in the world. So I think we have to recognize there's robust debate within artistic communities about this. And that's the first thing. I think the second thing is sometimes we're talking about AI being used without anybody even knowing that it's being used. So there's cases where musicians don't even know that their voice is being changed slightly. That's one example. But another case is we all know that these techniques of musical production employ AI to some extent to optimize, for example, voices. And I think what we're seeing now is a kind of great unveiling of all the ways that AI is already present in our production techniques. And I really think that that's the first step. It's like we have to understand the scale at which AI is being used in our creative industries right now, right? I think before we even get to legislating what the future is going to look like, we got to understand how is it being used today and where are the places where it seems like it's not an infringement, it's just another tool that people are using, and where are the places that it seems like it's being used unethically, without permission, to replace human labor and to steal intellectual and creative property?
Usually, AI has to be trained on something. So they're training on, not my creativity per se, but all of this, say these 200 artists, recognize that their work is being used as, you know, learning material for a machine that then will replicate them in some way. And that seems to me the biggest, most obvious way that that it's unethical, unethically used. And I don't know how you stop that, because AI becomes good, better, best by copying something. So I wonder if you two want to weigh in on that, Karen.
This whole thing about AI is a little bit of a catch-22 loop, right? Like in terms of like data learning and stuff, because effectively what it's doing is it's like, you know, it's like data mining all this music from throughout, say, the 20th century and 21st century, and using that to effectively, you know, if we kind of posit the like most dystopian version of it, it's like, you know, it can then replace the artist that it's learning from in the first place. So, you know, I think that's definitely like the worst case scenario. And I suspect that many, if not most of the artists who sign on to that document have similar anxieties about effectively them, their labor, their creativity, their output, their music output being replaced. So where do we draw the line? You know, how do we kind of differentiate between what is acceptable or even like welcome use of AI in music? And where do we just say that, you know, this is bad, we shouldn't allow it, period?
If you're just tuning in, this is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. I'm Callie Crossley. And here with me are Michael Jeffries, Professor of American Studies at Wellesley College, and Karen Wong, Lecturer on History and Literature at Harvard University. We're discussing the latest pop culture news. Is the horse already out of the barn, Michael? I'm looking at this new law that was signed by the governor of Tennessee called the Elvis Act, Ensuring Likeness, Voice, and Image Security Act, which is supposed to protect musicians. It goes into effect in July. No one knows, because it's the first of its kind in the country, how it's going to work or how it's going to police anything. But do you see this as a tool in a way to help artists protect themselves?
I think it's an interesting step. I mean, my understanding of that act is it's essentially an extension of the copyright law, because as you just described, what's happening is these machines are training on voices, right? Many, many, many voices over and over and over again, without acknowledgement that those voices are being used by the machine to produce the kind of newer, quote unquote, better voice. And I think that, you know, We've seen similar concerns raised not only in the film industry, but also in publishing, where we have writers concerned about AI-generated novels, right? And it's a very kind of similar situation where these machines are being trained on almost limitless amounts of data, text, right, written text, and producing these fictional novels. And writers are like, this is insane that our work has been used really without permission to train these models that will, that could replace us. So one of the things I'm looking for is whether we start to see some kind of crossover across industries, because we know that this is not limited to the music industry. We mentioned the film example. I just mentioned the publishing industry. It feels to me like if we try to solve this on a case-by-case, industry-by-industry basis, we're not really going to get to, I think, what the root of these issues are. So one of the things that I'm looking out for, I don't think the horse is out of the barn yet, we're at the very beginning of this story, is to what extent artists across industries start getting together and thinking through these problems as a collective, rather than as more sort of industry-separate solutions or new applications of the law to protect themselves from infringement.
Well, we're going to move on because the horse is definitely out of the barn on Cowboy Carter. That's Beyoncé's latest album. This is the first hit that, one of the first two hits that she released on Super Bowl. Here it is, Texas Hold'em.
This ain't Texas.
Okay, so that hit big and went crazy. People have, you know, have listening parties. They've, you know, got dances, all of that. She released that with 16 Carriages on Super Bowl Sunday, as I said, and teased the fact that the rest of the album was coming. It just hit last week at midnight, because that's like what she likes to do in a dramatic fashion. And since then, it's just broken every record you can imagine. I should mention that Texas Hold'em took her to the top of the Hot Country charts for the first time for a Black woman. And now she's broken all streaming records for her album, which has 27 cuts, all kinds of interludes in between, some collaborations with folks like Willie Nelson, and with some Black artists of some note, like Rihanna Giddens and others. And one of the songs that people are very excited about on the album, I mean, I think people are in general excited about the album, is Blackbird. And this is a cover of the Beatles song, and here's a little bit of that.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see.
So what we've learned since the album came out is that those are country artists, Black women country artists that she picked to help her sing the song, and we go on from there. So the album is both a triumph for her in terms of musicality, or seems to be at this point in terms of fan response and critical response, but also it's been an opportunity for her to highlight Black history, Black foundational history with country music, and highlight some artists who are already in the game but struggling to find their place and to belong. So, Karen, you can start off.
Yeah, so I'm just going to start with a disclaimer. I love this album. I'm so excited to talk about it. So I'm going to try my best to not sound like a complete fangirl, so please bear with me. But one thing I want to acknowledge is the roots of this album. Not only, you know, like Beyoncé's interest, general interest in thinking about the Black roots of country music, but also this allusion that she made on the Instagram post where she announced the album, talking, well, referencing kind of like indirectly this incident from 2016 when she was performing at the Country Music Awards, a song off of Lemonade, Daddy Lessons, with Natalie Maine from The Chicks. And, you know, that was incredibly, you know, it was a great performance, but they received a lot of backlash because some viewers of the CMAs were like, you know, these people don't belong in country music. And so when Beyoncé began working on the album, she said it came from, you know, an incident years ago where she didn't feel accepted. So I think it's really amazing to see her, you know, now atop the country charts with this new album.
Now, Michael, before you weigh in, here's Beyoncé accepting the Innovation Award at the 2024 iHeartRadio Music Awards. And that just happened. She is accepting it from Stevie Wonder.
Tonight, you call me an innovator, and for that, I'm very grateful. Innovation starts with a dream, but then you have to execute that dream, and that road can be very bumpy. Being an innovator is seeing what everyone believes is impossible. Being an innovator often means being criticized, which often will test your mental strength. Being an innovator is leaning on faith and trusting that God will catch you and guide you. So, to all the record labels, every radio station, every award show, my hope is that we're more open to the joy and liberation that comes from enjoying art with no preconceived notions.
So, Michael Jeffries, Dean of Academic Affairs and Professor of American Studies at Wellesley College, what say you?
It almost seems like she's, you know, really taking the idea of genre itself to task, right? Like, the statement that it's a Beyoncé album, it's not a country album. She's not trying to make a country album here, right? That wasn't her goal. That wasn't what she said she was trying to do. She's trying to sort of move beyond genre. And of course, I think she's already done that in many respects throughout her career. She's crossed, I think, traditional genre lines over and over again. But genre is a strange thing because on one hand, it's this sometimes really short-sighted and almost insidious and wrong-headed creation of the record industry, right? Where they kind of slap these names on these things because they think it will appeal to these imaginary audiences that may or may not exist. But on the other hand, genre is also built by music scenes that are legitimate sort of grassroots musical movements almost, right? So there's this competing, I think, relationship to genre where on one hand, we want to reject it because it's this industry creation. And on the other hand, we want to acknowledge that, you know, if I say I'm a jazz fan, if I say I'm a hip hop fan or a rock fan, I'm not just saying I like the records that the record company tells me are rock records. I'm saying this is a community of people that I understand that I belong to. So when we push back against genre, we're actually trying to reckon with what communities do I see myself as part of? And I think what's happened in Beyoncé's case is, and certainly in the case of Taylor Swift and many others, we've started to see like the brand of the artist has become a genre itself, right? Like the Beehive is a genre. Right? Swiftiness, that's a genre now, the way I'm kind of experiencing it, right? That's where the sense of community comes from. Not necessarily because it's one type of music that these people are doing, but the persona and the brand of the artist has become its own kind of category of community. And that's what's so fascinating to me about this is it's a challenge to the idea of genre and a creeping toward a replacement of genre with an almost cultish community created around the artist and their brand and their personality themselves.
And she does have a serious brand community, that being the Beehive you have referenced. So Karen and I have confessed that we love this album. How about you?
I like some songs on it. It's not really my type of music, but, you know, when Texas Hold'em comes on, I definitely dance. So I'm halfway in, halfway out.
Okay, you got it. It's not getting you up either.
Sometimes.
Okay. Totally. All right. Just asking. Changing tone totally. Well, not tone, but just a different thing. Kevin Hart, people may know him. He's by his height. Most people know him by his height. He's a very short comedian, and he's made the most of that in his career. I say comedian, but he's actually an actor and acquainted himself in some other kinds of roles, but he's best known for his humor. He just received the prestigious Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. And I pointed out because that prize is considered to be the top in the comedy world, and that makes him comedy royalty. And it wasn't so long ago when he was battling a controversy, which he seems to have come out on the other side and done way better. So, Michael, what do you say about Kevin Hart getting the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor?
He's had a remarkable career. But I'm also interested in what we consider to be sort of comedy royalty these days, right? Because in Hart's case, I would argue that most of his fans sort of know him as the kind of actor-producer role and not as the sort of king of stand-up or something like that, right? And when you start giving these kinds of awards to folks who really, it seems like they're movie stars first and then comedians second, I think it raises some questions about how we consume comedy and what we're looking for in terms of comedic greatness. And those are kind of the kind of questions that I'm especially interested in with respect to Hart. As someone who has seen a movie of his here and there, but would never consider him to be in the same class as, some of the historically great comedians in American history.
Karen, what do you say?
In terms of like this debate about his cultural legacy, which, you know, is like kind of like thrust into the spotlight with the Mark Twain Prize, you know, I'm just looking at the list of like past winners in the recent years. In 2023, we had Adam Sandler, and then before that was Jon Stewart, Dave Chappelle, Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Just thinking about those names, you can think about how the impact they've had as comedians, right? But they also have been comedians in pretty different contexts. Like, you know, I think Louis-Dreyfus is primarily known for comedy roles in TV, and then Dave Chappelle is a stand-up comedian, and then Jon Stewart, was once the host of The Daily Show and is now the host of The Daily Show again. So I think, you know, I don't want to make too definite of a judgment about Kevin Hart's cultural legacy as a comedian, because I think it's a bit subjective, right? But I think with regard to the award, at least, there is a degree of flexibility in, you know, who they assess as comedians worthy of the prize.
If you're just tuning in, this is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. I'm Callie Crossley, and I'm here with Michael Jeffries, professor of American Studies at Wellesley College, and Karen Wong, lecturer on history and literature at Harvard University. We're talking about the big stories in pop culture. I want to close out just because I'm just curious about these things. There are two, it's really hard to get blockbusters at the theater now these days. The last ones were really actually Beyonce and Taylor Swift, their concert movies. But right now, Godzilla versus Kong and Ghostbusters are riding high. Here's a clip from the trailer for Godzilla versus Kong.
For most of human civilization, we believed that life could only exist on the surface of our planet. What else were we wrong about?
And then here's a clip from the new Ghostbusters.
I've been waiting 40 years for this. They called themselves Ghostbusters. According to these hacks, they saved the world. No eyewitnesses. And who is found to carry the torch? Descendants of Egon Spengler.
Now, the reason I played both those clips and I wanted to get you all to weigh in, they're just blowing through the charts. They're making all kinds of money. People are rushing to see them. I was interested, Michael, in why do you think they, at this moment, this is something that people are seeking?
There's no mistaking the fact that the roots of these stories culturally are found in a really different generational moment. And that's why I feel so strongly that they may not be, you know, lessons specifically about what's going on today, right this minute, so much as they are evidence of a desire to return to something that occurred before, right? To put yourself back in a place when life was simpler, when we consumed movies differently, when we weren't expecting every movie to have a really sort of powerful moral lesson and be social commentary. I wonder about those kinds of forces playing out with the success of these films.
And would you agree, Karen?
Yeah, I think one thing that I would add, and this is purely speculative, is I wonder, you know, just like thinking about the brand name that these two franchises have established over the past decades, I wonder if, you know, the recency of these latest releases also are drawing in younger audiences who, you know, probably weren't alive when the first King Kong or Godzilla or Ghostbusters movies came out, because there's something about nostalgia that is, you know, obviously relevant to the people who lived through earlier periods. But also, I feel like something that is in cultural cachet right now is nostalgia for periods when people were not alive yet.
I'm going to squeeze one thing in here. Just, I feel I would love to get you both to comment on Oprah and the weight loss and the weight drug whole scenario. I mean, after a long period of time, if folks don't know, she was dieting and then she was taking the drug. She was also an ambassador for Weight Watchers, which, of course, originally involved no drugs. Now they have a part of that. So she was taking an Ozempic-like drug, or Ozempic, I'm not sure which, and finally confessed to that and then as put together a television special to talk about the shame of being heavy and what she went through and drug therapy being good for some people who have issues and blah, blah, blah. And I just wonder what you thought about, you know, just her whole involvement in the way that this story came about, and because she's huge culturally. So whatever she does, people are going to pay attention to. Karen, what did you take away from the Oprah weight loss? Sometimes I tell you what I'm doing. Now I told you what I'm doing. Then the big special at the end.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure, to be honest. I think Oprah, you know, obviously she is a cultural icon. But at the same time, as you mentioned, she has received a lot of like fat shaming in the past. So I think, you know, her contending with just kind of like the negative press she's released about her body it must be like, you know, like a really cathartic thing for her to do. But at the same time, I do also wonder about just like kind of like the potential prevalence of Ozempic and Ozempic-like drugs in Hollywood, because, you know, obviously these are like medicinal like subscriptions. Prescriptions, right? But at the same time, I think there's a real concern that people in Hollywood who are already seen as traditionally thin are using them to get thinner. And I think I actually find that to be a more concerning thing, because I think, you know, regular Americans already have enough to contend with in regards to their body image as is. And so like, if we leave aside the kind of like beneficial uses of Ozempic, etc., as it's intended for, you know, how do we contend with its like potentially negative consequences for people who don't need it at all?
So, Michael, would you say that Karen's saying that Oprah is essentially promoting the culture of thinness? What's your take on that? I'm saying that's what Karen said, but you can respond differently.
I think Karen's comments were really thoughtful and important. You know, we already do, many people already idolize these folk, and being able to read their sort of public presentations without critically thinking about these issues, it's a way to lead us down a very, you know, dangerous path. You know, I think what's been interesting to me about the Oprah case is the way she has framed it as a way to free herself from the shame. And it's very difficult for me as an outsider when someone sort of discloses that, right, to really push back on it anyway, because I don't know what she's been going. Certainly, we have an awareness she's a public figure and the spotlight is always on her, and we know that she has been subject to this kind of shaming for much of her professional life. But I think we have to take that very seriously when someone says it and almost sort of take it at face value. I think the difficult thing is, as much as she has tried to put the drug in balance with some of the other lifestyle changes that she has emphasized, it feels like a very difficult line to walk where it's hard to tell whether you're focused, whether she is focused on the image and the perception or her own conception of what is a healthy and happy life. It's a very difficult line for her to navigate, I think, and then for us as fans and consumers to navigate as well. So certainly something I'll be paying attention to.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. And I am delighted to have talked to both of you once again. So thanks for joining me.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you both.
Thank you.
We're going out on Sweet Honey Bucking, another song from Beyoncé's Cowboy Carter album. Coming up, American adoption is often portrayed as an overwhelmingly positive solution, the best possible solution for the unborn child of a woman in a crisis pregnancy. However, studies reveal that most women in that situation want to keep their babies. Author Gretchen Sisson explains why that doesn't often happen in her new book, Relinquished: The Politics of Adoption and the Privilege of American Motherhood. It's our April selection for Bookmarked, the Under the Radar Book Club. That's next. This is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. I'm Callie Crossley. Put some grits on the stove. Jiffy cornbread, booty corn fed, body rolls at the rodeo. I'm coming home. Riding through just to put my eyes on you. You are the superstar. Everybody's driving no new cars. Turn a bad night to a good time on a trail ride to the Zydeco. I'm coming home. Sweet country home.